on this episode of Optimal Health Uncovered.
When somebody requests for a brand, no matter what it is, but we will also explain to them that that brand, just because your brother's sister's husband's wife is wearing that and swears by it and she's a 230 marathoner, doesn't mean that you are going to be perfect for that brand.
Welcome to Optimal Health Uncovered, Marathon Mondays edition. I'm Britt Gunzer.
And I'm Brendan Copley.
Once again, we want you to think of us as your post-race banana, but before the race, helping you to prepare for your fall race as best as possible.
Today, we are talking with Megan Sirfoss, who is the owner of Ridgefield and Darien Running Company, to discuss all things footwear. Megan, why don't you start us off with telling us a little bit about yourself, your history with the sport, and the running stores in general.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for having me. I really enjoy Performance Optimal Health. It's been a great part of my marathon training, always being able to check in and making sure that I'm healthy. I am a longtime runner. I started running when I was 30 years old, just as the easiest thing to get out the door when I started having children and I was working full time. So from that, I actually worked with my sister back before cell phones, and we were talking on a connected phone. I was in Southern California. She was in Northern California. And she said, let's train for a race. And I thought, great. My first race ever was the Big Sur Marathon.
Wow. Yeah. Cool. Awesome.
So America's toughest marathon, yeah. I think, hilliest. and I trained just by reading as much as I could. I was an athletic trainer in college, and So always had just enough to be dangerous and knowing anatomy and physiology and how things worked, and really fell in love with the sport of running. I finished that marathon, and that was the first of maybe 30 that I've done so far.
Cool.
Moved to Connecticut in 2006. So about 17 years ago, and quickly went to go find my running store, and there wasn't one in the area. And running stores were my community. I came from Naperville, Illinois, which were Naperville Running Company, a great running store that has incredible community and really was my sort of family. I came to Ridgefield and there was nothing there. And so many years went by where I was just having stuff shipped to me. And then I realized that with running shoes and performance gear, you can't buy things online. Mm-hmm. You can't mail order them. You can't even call your best friend that lives in Naperville and have her send them to you. You actually have to go try things on.
You've already shocked half of the listeners, probably.
So in 2013, started the idea of opening up Ridgefield Running Company, and we opened in October 2014 and quickly realized that the people that we see are coming in because they have either done the research online and want to actually try the shoe. They're smart enough to do that, try the shoe that works for them, or they just actually have zero guidance in what is the proper running shoe for them.
So, sorry to cut you off, but I already knew you were about to say something, but I just got so excited. I didn't realize you were an athletic trainer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I went to athletic training school at Quinnipiac University as well, and I felt like it was so helpful when I was working in the footwear industry. Did you find that totally like reframed your fit process and the way that you were kind of going through your evaluations for that, or were they two disconnected things?
I think to a certain extent I'm very orthopedically curious. Yep. And so I always like to see the way things move. And with the technologies that we use in our store, the 3D scanner and the pressure mat, and just listening and learning from our customer base, we're able to really dive down into how a shoe works, what's functioning, what's not. And also, I think that because I have that orthopedic curiosity and that sports medicine background, it's really great to be able to train everybody that comes to work for me. So we're constantly learning from people like Performance Optimal Health on what is going on with a person and how we can help make that person run more comfortably or just even move forward more comfortably.
So I was chomping at the bit to address that you already said something that we're going to talk about later, the difference between actually going to a running store and ordering things online. I find it interesting that running shoes, working with a lot of runners, is something that novices will very often just purchase because someone that they know has this that works for them, where you wouldn't buy a car because it works for your friend. You wouldn't buy a pair of jeans because it works for your friend, but they do so with running shoes. So can you talk to us about what you think an ideal running fitting is, what is necessary, and what is a benefit of going to a running store versus just buying a brand online?
Yeah, so we're in this really crazy social media traffic type of world where stuff is being fed to us all the time. Mm-hmm. And then we hear it and we say it and Siri follows us, and all of a sudden we're being delivered ads. And so we get a lot of people that will come in and say, hey, I want to buy that hookah brand. And I'll say, you know, hookah you smoke, hookah you wear. And so we will always start when somebody requests for a brand, no matter what it is. But we will also explain to them that that brand, just because your brother's sister's husband's wife is wearing that and swears by it, and she's a 230 marathoner, doesn't mean that you mm-hmm. are going to be perfect for that brand. So trying to identify what the person is using the shoe for, if they have injuries, hips, knees, ankles, back, things that are going on, we kind of, and then we do the scan, we kind of dial it down and say, okay, well, we can put you in a Hoka, but it might not be the best shoe for you. And here are the reasons why, and here's a list of, or here's four other examples of shoes that you can have. So we try to show them all possibilities and not just somebody told them they needed to buy it.
Do you feel that people are generally open to that, or they come in wanting a Hoka and they're like, ugh.
They are open to it once they see our fit process.
Yeah.
They're willing to kind of see, and they'll walk out with a Hoka a lot of the times. I mean, it's a great shoe.
Right.
It's not, and I don't want to be brand specific like that, but it really is more of let us be the expert and figure out the shoe that's going to work, or the brand that's going to work best for you. And it may be even a brand and not the shoe style that they came in with. It may be the brand and a different shoe style mm-hmm. within that same brand. So there are people that come in and they're loyalists and they have to have a certain brand, but after you put them in several different shoes, then they can really decide. Their foot brain decides.
Right. And can you just walk us through what your fitting process is? Because not everyone's familiar with the technology that you guys use.
Sure. So we greet a person. Hey, Brandon, what brings you in today? And we greet somebody and we do a quick evaluation, just asking them what brings them in, what's going on. We fit a lot of people. We fit a tremendous amount of athletes, but we also fit people that just need to be in a shoe that feels good, whether they've just had their hip replaced or they're standing and working at Costco all day or whatever. A lot of medical people too. And we take them, we find out if they're just talking to them, kind of just a base evaluation, what's going on, tell me about your life. And then we scan them, and everybody, 100% of the people that come in will get scanned. And the only time they don't is if they opt out of it. Mm-hmm. Or they're too young, because sometimes kids under the age of 13, we just like to visually look at them. We don't want to change too much. They're still mm-hmm. growing. Or maybe a senior citizen that's a little bit unstable and just benefits more from a traditional setup, measuring Brannick, the old tool that you put on the floor.
Yeah.
So then we scan them, and we use the Volumental and Superfeet 3D fit process. So it's a 3D scanner, and then they walk across a mat that picks up pressure points. And through that, it sort of levels the playing field for all of our fitters, because I have fitters that have been working for me for 10 years, and I have fitters that have been working for me for a year. But the information that they get is all the same, so it gives them a really great starting point. Mm-hmm. And from there, we can actually see how the foot moves. Lots of times, we'll see somebody, and they'll come in, and they'll say, I have a completely flat foot. And you scan them, and the 3D scan says they have a flat foot. But then when they walk, their arch appears. And so it's sort of interesting. We're able to kind of fit and feel from that scan.
Yeah.
So then typically what we'll do is we may even measure them again on the Brannick if we feel like their heel-to-ball mm-hmm. measurement is different, because you could measure a size 12 heel-to-toe, meaning that would, you probably put in a 12 and a half, 13. But if your heel to ball is longer, meaning that your articulation point of where the shoe naturally bends, maybe your heel to toe, a 12, but right. heel to ball, you have a 13 arch. So we might put you in that 13 shoe so that the shoe bends exactly where it should. So we'll look at that. And then we'll pull three pairs of shoes, typically on the first pull, of shoes that we think will work best for you. We also have and really firmly believe in insoles.
Yeah, I use them. I buy them from you.
Because if you are a size 12 shoe and say you're a size 12, and Brandon, you're size 12, and I'm a size 12. I may have a high rigid arch, and you may have a flat floppy foot, and somebody has something in between. The shoe brands don't know what your arch type is like. And so by putting in an insole, either a one personalized insole or just an off-the-shelf insole, we can help dial the shoe in for you quite a bit.
Does your fit process look differently for fitting for a semi-custom orthotic than it would for a shoe itself?
So our fit process is exactly the same. And through our fit station, we are able to analyze and show somebody what the personalized insole would look like. And I want to really clarify, because it is not really an orthotic. Orthotics are done by doctors, and they have shims and cants and are playing with leg length differential and things like that. This is more of like, hey, look, this is her arch, and this is what it looks like, and these are her pressure points. Let's put in an insole that is exactly personalized to her, and it will kind of, it has flex lines in it to kind of put your best foot forward. It's not doing it overly correction, because we don't want to do that, but it's all available, and our fitters can show somebody right away exactly what that insole will look like. And I'll say that since we started this 3D fit process, which has been about 5 years, we've sold probably 3,000 or 4,000 pairs of personalized insoles and probably gotten 30 back.
Wow. That's
and
incredible.
They're guaranteed. Yeah. So it's like, it's interesting because people spend a lot of time investing in a custom ski boot and a fit for a fixed sport. And here we're doing a sport that we're moving, or we're walking, or we're running, or we're just doing anything that's moving forward, and we're not personalizing it.
Right.
And for $119, which is what the personalized insole is, it's well worth it.
I didn't even know you guys offered that.
Yeah,
that's cool. Really cool.
Yeah.
Do you do that for footwear as well, too, in addition to the insole, or is it just the insole?
It's just the insole. They're not personalizing shoes quite yet.
Yeah. Or I meant like for your fit guarantee. Like, do you offer like a period of time that they can trial the shoe? And
yes. So our fitters do a pretty good job. We want you to love the shoe right when you walk out the door. So our return rate is pretty small.
Awesome.
Because we hopefully spent a lot of time, and there's no question in your thought, or you're not walking out the door thinking, oh, did I like this? Do I like the way it feels?
Yeah.
If there's any little bit of hesitance when you're walking out the door, it's only going to magnify. And that's the only thing you're going to pay attention to when you start your run. Ooh, I felt this niggle here.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll go away. Mm-mm, it's not going to go away. If it doesn't feel good in the store, don't bring it out. But we do have a 2-week return policy, which even we just want you to go out and run in the shoe and really like it. And if you don't like it, we'll bring it back.
That's amazing. I feel like that makes such a difference to like the level of confidence, one, of your fit process, and then to just comfort for that person leaving, that they know that they can at least try it, and if all else fails, and they can bring it back and make sure that they're taken care of.
It's super interesting because throughout all run specialty stores, and I'm talking about the industry as a whole, our return rate, the average return rate when you go to a run specialty store is about 6%. When you buy online, it's more than double.
Yeah,
I would totally believe that.
Yeah, because you're buying based on the famous runner that you see on Instagram wearing the shoe.
Right.
You know, it's not for you, which is exactly why I said, talk to us about what you guys do. Why are we not ordering on www.brandname.com? So you want to pivot and talk a little bit more about like types of shoes?
Yeah, I think that'd be helpful. So, we have... I guess we can break this down into a number of different ways, but I think of this as like giant categories and then subcategories. So for your giant categories of shoes, how would you explain some of the differences between a road running shoe, a trail shoe, and then a shoe that somebody would wear to either weightlift or cross train in?
At both stores, Ridgefield Running and Darien Running, we have all of our shoes are meant to move forward. So any type of forward movement is going to fit into the shoes that we sell. We sell a couple pickleball shoes because I hear that's kind of popular.
Just a bit.
I need a pickleball shoe store. And but all of them are meant to move forward. And so we have categories within that, as you mentioned, road, trail. And then within that, we have subcategories of stability, neutral stability, moderate cushion, high cushion, low cushion. So there's all sorts of different things. So listening to the customer and finding out what's going on with them is the first thing. The difference between road shoes and trail shoes is just the lugs. Most all of trail shoes are neutral. So if anybody has any insufficiencies or things that are happening, big pronation issues, we would put an insert in there for sure, try to help guide them forward. But trail shoes just have bigger lugs on them. Sometimes they're Gore-Tex, and they're actually sort of, the reason most of them are neutral is because when you run on trails, you're more mindful. You have to watch where every step goes. And so you're a little bit more careful with your foot placement. And that's why trail running is so awesome, because you're using all of your body all the time. Where those that just road run, we tend to just plod straight forward. We might not be paying attention to every footfall because we're running on soft, smooth surfaces. So with a road shoe, we have the three different categories of light cushion, moderate cushion, and high cushion. And typically we will put our younger athletes in light cushion to medium or moderate cushion shoes and reserve the high cushion because they are a higher dollar cost for somebody that's having a back issue, somebody that really wants that feeling of the of not feeling the road, that sort of high cushion, really nice feeling shoe. And usually it's a little bit plusher feeling. And those shoes usually run about $160 to a little bit higher. The moderate cushion shoes, your bread and butter, that's the shoes that most everybody will fit in nicely. Good amount of cushioning. You can, you know, feel the surface, but not incredibly. And then you have your lighter cushion shoe, which we tend to put in to somebody that really wants to feel the road, or they're running on the track a lot, soft surfaces, or they're a younger athlete and they're a little bit healthier than some of us. Higher cushion shoes, as we get older, one of the few places that we lose fat in our body is our heel. And so, again, putting an insert in where you have a really nice heel cup, because that will give you a little more fat pad to work off of, but also a higher cushion shoe is really great for an older person. What we're trying to do is make you as comfortable as possible so you can get out and do what you need to do. And if, you know, sometimes people will say to us, well, I don't want that high cushion shoe because it's going to weaken my foot, or it's going to make something different with what I'm doing. Listen, if that high cushion shoe gets you out the door every day, why not use a little aid? And so that's kind of the way that we go. Then within those categories, you have a neutral shoe and you have a stability shoe. Go back about 10 years, and anytime somebody at a shoe store saw any bit of pronation, they would put them in these big, there's a shoe made by Brooks called the Beast.
Yep.
The Brooks Beast, this huge concrete brick of a shoe. And actually it's a really nice shoe now. It's they've updated it quite a bit. But anytime we saw any pronation, we would automatically put somebody in a stability shoe. And that's where talking to somebody that's qualified to say, yeah, you do pronate, but you don't, your hips, knees, ankles are fine. You're compensating for it. So let's keep you in a neutral shoe and not put you in that big shoe that's going to push you out a little bit or keep you from falling in. So I think at our stores, we bend very heavily on the neutral, moderate cushion shoe. And then with the people that are coming in that are having hips, knees, ankles issues, we would look at a light stability shoe. But we really have sort of moved to that, not overcorrecting.
I gotcha. So I guess even within this, this brings up another topic of categories of shoe, and we can talk about the drop of a shoe. So and for a little bit of time, there was like the minimalist movement where all they were saying barefoot running is the best possible option. Then they almost went the exact opposite. Maximalist, you want the most amount of cushion possible. And now maybe I don't even know where we are personally. I feel like it's a little ambiguous. But can you talk a little bit about stack height versus just the overall drop of the shoe and how that matters for certain people or even for certain types of running strides?
Sure. So I think that the biggest thing about barefoot running, or the biggest benefit, were the physical therapists.
Yes, correct.
Everybody thought that they had to run barefoot, and yeah. We are just not all built to, we were growing up wearing shoes. And so it was a great boom for orthopedics when those books came out that said that we needed to run barefoot. And barefoot's not bad, but it has to be done gently and carefully. And also, you know, there can be a lot of issues with that. And so if we want to keep moving forward, maybe a little cushion to protect our feet from the ground is recommended. And so then to your point, they did go the other way. We have shoes that are now what we call maximal shoes, maximum cushion shoes that look like they're going to make you 3 feet taller. They actually, you sit pretty far into the shoe. So it's kind of like the cushion is surrounding your whole foot. And those are great. But if somebody has issues with stability, they're older, or they have weaknesses, sometimes falling off of that platform might not be great. You don't really see it because you do sit into the shoe, but we would keep somebody that maybe has Parkinson's or that sort of thing away from a big cushion shoe. Those big cushion shoes you're referring to as the stack height. When we talk about ramp height, we talk about the heel to the foot drop. And so a barefoot shoe, Ultra, is a balanced cushion shoe, is basically zero millimeters of drop between the heel and the forefoot. That shoe is great for somebody that has really great foot control, really great anatomy.
Yeah, ankle mobility, foot mobility, yep.
Yep. And then when you go up in ramp height for there, it used to be probably even as late as 10 years ago, that almost every running shoe was about a 10 to 12 mil ramp, which is pretty tall. So from your heel down to your forefoot, it's 10 millimeters of drop. And then the minimal movement made it so that it was zero. And then we started kind of bumping up, and people can find their sweet spot, whether it's a 5 millimeter drop or an 8 millimeter drop. Most shoes are falling into that now. But we do look at the fact, when somebody comes in, if they have a high hamstring injury, anything on the back side of them, we stay up elevated in drop because we want to take the pressure off of the whole backside of your body.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because obviously with what Brendan and I do, me as a physical therapist, I see a lot of people coming in with a certain type of shoe, and they'll have Achilles tendon issues, chronic plantar fasciitis, blah, 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 and they're wearing really the wrong shoe. And I send them to someone like you, and it's really just a matter of getting the heel drop a little bit higher to put some of those tissues on slack, and it fixes them and allows them to train again.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because, again, people think that they need to, somebody told them that they need to stay at zero drop. Yeah. Somebody told them that this is the best thing. And again, we just want you to be able to move forward comfortably, and that shoe's probably not for you.
So talking about trends in running a little bit more, and still kind of sort of on the concept of drop, there's definitely been talk on either, you know, more of a 4 foot running strike or a heel strike, and kind of what's the ideal strike. Have you gotten that question a lot? What are some of your thoughts on running stride in general, and maybe tying it in a little bit with running cadence or whatever your thought process is?
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun when somebody comes in and you put them on the treadmill and they're running on the ball of their foot. And the first thing I will say is, are you a sprinter?
Yeah.
That's the only person that should be running on the ball of their foot. And the next thing is to bring out our little bone set of the foot and show somebody those little chicken bones that make up your metatarsals and show them and say, listen, you're putting 4 times your body weight when you land on that. Would you rather put it on your midfoot and your heel or on those little chicken bones that are out there in front? And so when you look at the anatomy of an ankle and a foot, you see this big heel bone. It's there for a reason. Mm-hmm. And it's meant to receive force. And then you go further up the foot and you look at the midfoot and the bones are still big. So there's a lot of place to absorb shock there. So it's more of teaching people, listen, we want you to land. The natural gait is to land for a second on your heel and a millisecond, mm-hmm. and then just roll straight through. And you might pronate a little bit. Everybody does. And then toe off neutral. And when you explain that to them and then explain them that running really comes from your core, and making sure that you're standing tall, leaning forward a little bit, but that all of your footfalls should happen directly underneath your body. Mm-hmm. And then that brings up a much quicker cadence, which, as we all know, a higher cadence is going to keep you less in your office.
Yeah.
More on the ground, on the road. So, and that's kind of a nice thing to do, is when you say, hey, look at you, pick your cadence up. 180 is that magic number. If you can get to 155 to 165, that's awesome. You can get a little bit higher. That's great. And that quick turnover, keeping your feet lower to the ground, you're not going to be putting as much force down on your foot, but then using your whole foot, super, super important.
Yeah. I mean, biomechanically, exactly what you said, it does not necessarily matter where you land. It matters where you land in relation to the center of your mass. But I still see on my Instagram and social media feeds all the time the big red X across somebody that's landing on their heel. Do you find when someone comes into your store and you see them run and they're on the ball of their foot, is that their natural way of running, or have they gone, oh no, I trained to do this?
It's probably 50-50.
Yeah.
You'll get a lot of people that are sprinters, and so they have a hard time transitioning into a regular footfall from their tiptoe. You have people that have come in that were tiptoe walkers as kids, and so they're always right. going to be on their forefoot. In that case, we would treat them the same way that we treat somebody that's supinating, and that is just putting them in the most cushion they can have in their forefoot and giving them something underneath their arch, so that if we can put a little bit of support underneath their arch, it takes a little bit more stress off the forefoot. So that's sort of one of the ways that we work with that. But if they said, oh, I read a book,
yeah,
then we kind of try to retrain them. And we are not in the business of doing gait analysis. That's not who we are. We're looking at the way the foot falls and right. the way the foot moves through space. We're not coaching anybody. That's for somebody else to do. But we do go those simple tips: stand tall, lean forward, you know, your arms need to move from, you know, your midline and not drop down and not cross your body. And then just kind of concentrating on landing on that midfoot.
So we talked about types of shoes. There's a million different types, a million different ways you can go. So let's dive in a little bit. What are your thoughts on a shoe rotation? And what do you usually advise people who are training for a half marathon or a marathon? What do you talk rotation wise about?
I love shoe rotation.
Me too.
But I also own a running store and have a lot of shoes. So it's hard to tell somebody, you know, really, if you're training for the New York City Marathon, three pairs of shoes would be awesome. And then you're going to buy the shoe you're going to race in again a couple weeks before, as long as the make and model hasn't changed. And that's a hard thing to say, but I tell people it's kind of like a mood ring. When I wake up in the morning and I'm going for a run, if it's a fast poppy run, I want a fast poppy shoe. If my legs are really tired, I might even go with a shoe that has, and I'm a very neutral runner, a little bit of stability in it, because my foot doesn't have to work as hard. Now we have carbon shoes, and that's a whole nother topic, but you know, that's a great thing to throw into the mix as well. So three pairs of shoes, a nice shoe for your long runs that is cushioned and will carry you the distance, a shoe for your faster speed work days, or just like, you know, there's some days where you might just have a 3 mile run and it's a beautiful day and you're running in Westport and you mm-hmm. want to just be cruising. That's kind of a fun shoe to just throw on and have fun with. And then that other, the shoe that you're actually going to race in, which could be one of those shoes, but another shoe.
And what do you recommend for people to break in your race day shoe?
So I always tell people, figure out which shoe you want to run in early in your training cycle. We're 11 weeks out right now from the New York City Marathon and most fall marathons. And so right now you should be thinking about what shoe you're going to race in. If it's a carbon plated shoe, those have a little bit of a shorter life to them. They're getting a lot better. When the Nike Vaporfly, which was one of the first ones, came out, they told everybody it was about a 100-mile shoe. Now they've figured out how to make it so it lasts a little bit longer. But I always recommend to people, if you find a shoe you like and the model is still in line, to buy it 2 weeks before. Again, trust me, when you're at mile 22 and you're in the shoe that you trained for the entire marathon training thing, you're going to say, why didn't I buy another shoe? Knowing you're starting a race with a fresh shoe is super important. That's great for your psyche.
What's the normal lifespan of like a daily trainer, that cushioned long run shoe?
So we typically will tell people that a shoe will last 350 to 500 miles. If the guy is 6'2 and 240 pounds, he's going to go 350.
Right.
If it's a young high school athlete, she may get to, you know, cross country and winter track out of it. And speaking specifically to the high school kids, because a lot of them, their parents will buy them one shoe for cross country and then they come back again for cross country the next year and they've worn it for three seasons plus the summer. And this is the only piece of equipment that you buy. You should invest in your child and their equipment. But 350 to 500, some shoes last a little bit longer. The maximal cushion shoes, we might get a little bit more. But typically what we tell people is if you're doing the same exercise, you're running the same amount, you're not throwing in Zumba or something, pickleball or something that you've never done. If you're doing the same exact thing all the time and all of a sudden things start to feel a little niggly, your hips start to ache after a run, something like that, it's likely your shoe needs to be replaced. But if it's a new exercise that you're doing, it's probably not the shoe.
All right, let's talk carbon plated shoes. So this could probably be a whole podcast episode in and of itself, but let's just go quickly through some pros and cons, some things that you've noticed with trends over time with carbon plated.
Yeah, and maybe first just tell the listeners what the plate does, what it is, what it does.
The plate is so fabulous, right?
It totally changed
the way a lot of people run and the way a lot of people race. The one thing that I do want to say is you can't buy speed. And so if you're not doing the training and you're not strengthening your body, a carbon plated shoe is not going to give you that 4%. It's not going to make you any bit faster. So investing in a $250 shoe isn't the way to run a marathon if you haven't put the work in. And really, I kind of say that anytime that you're doing something where you're adding in speed work or you're adding in a new carbon plated shoe, you really should have at least a 500 mile base before you do that, because carbon plates can kind of also change the way you run. They do
definitely
change the rate you run. And so if you're not strong to begin with, it might highlight some of the problems. So carbon plates are stiff. And when you think of what it does, one, it keeps your big toe really from flexing. So a natural gait, you know, you kind of toe off and you have that little bend where your toe, your big toe meets the rest of your foot. I'm trying to put this in layman's terms.
Yep,
so we can all
think about
that. It's not happening. And so you kind of miss that whole step and you run through the gait cycle. It's just kind of like if you could think of what a bike does and the rim of a bike and how it cycles forward, there's no secondary bend. So it's pushing you the best place forward. And then there's a little bit of a rebound or response to it that's going to keep your turnover typically a little bit higher. They are awesome. We recommend that if you train in them, because people love to be speed and we're all sort of Strava influenced, and we're Garmin influenced or whatever, Coros, whatever watch you wear, when it gives you a little like kudos or it's a little trophy. Yes, we want to keep doing that for every single run. And so what we do is we start to wear our carbon all the time, and that's not good. And I think that the same with barefoot shoes, the jury's still out. Like, I don't know if you as PTs are seeing things that are carbon related, but it definitely does put probably a little bit more stress on your knees.
Yes.
Just because of the way that the forward movement is.
Yeah. And it offloads the Achilles a little bit. It changes your mechanics entirely. So I've seen a slew of different injuries from hip to knee usually. And when you break down what the person's running in, it's usually just a casual 3 to 5 miles a couple times a week. They're running in a plated shoe. And why? But it's not helping them. They think it is, but it's actually hurting their anatomy.
And I also feel that if you have any bone sensitivity, I fell trail running a couple of years ago and had a pretty significant bone bruise. And to this day, I can get about 13 miles out of a carbon shoe. And then I start to feel that exact spot.
Oh, which, interesting.
Yeah, because I think that it's just firm enough underneath. Now, they've done really great in hiding carbon. We're putting more cushion around them. More brands are coming out with these super shoes that are just, I mean, it's like Tigger. You just feel like you're just like bouncing down the street, and it's such a fabulous feeling, and it's very addictive. But I kind of recommend 2 days a week at the most. If you're running 4 to 6, I would do probably 25 to 30% of my my mileage, my weekly mileage could be in a carbon shoe. I also myself don't like to wear them as much because I want to feel that race day feel on race day, and I want to be excited about it. I want to train in it, but I don't want to overtrain in it. And one of the things, like you said, people are getting more addicted to it. A lot of brands are coming out with kind of carbon copies, if so, like maybe
PBAX
or a plastic plate, which is a really great midpoint to go. So you can, like, for example, just to use let's use Hoka for an example. They have the Mach X, which is a PBAX plate, and then they have the Rocket X, which is the carbon plate, built on the same last. Everything's built the same. One's plastic, one's carbon. Same with Saucony, they're doing the same thing right now. And it's really nice because you can still have that fast poppy shoe, and it's not going to be as fast as the carbon, but you've trained with that sort of feel. And then the other instance that we are really using carbon shoes, and it's wonderful, is anybody that has arthritis in their toe, their big toe, or any hallucis rigidus, anything like that. You can get somebody that has not been able to walk at all comfortably out moving. And it's really incredible. I have a daughter that's 31 years old and she has arthritis in her big toe. And what a drag. But she wears a carbon plated shoe and she can do anything she wants.
And are you recommending, like, my latest obsession is the New Balance Super Comp trainer. Mm. Oh my God. Are you recommending something like that for that population where it's a cushioned and not necessarily, it could be a race day shoe, right? But it's also a training shoe.
I love that shoe. Yeah. So that's a very, very high cushion
very,
shoe.
Yes.
They market it as a trainer. It was one of the first carbon shoes that they came out with. And for the, when they first made it a couple years ago, it wasn't like, you couldn't win the Boston Marathon mm-hmm. if you were wearing it because mm-hmm. it wasn't legal. And now it is. And so people can race in that. If they want that really maximal cushion shoe with that carbon plate, that's a great option. You don't need to go to a super high performance carbon trainer, but that would be something that we would offer to somebody that has that mobility limitation. The funny thing is that all these $200 plus shoes, which are carbon plated, all come in really fast, racy, sexy colors.
Of course.
And sometimes the population of person that needs that doesn't necessarily want that race.
The
look.
Orange
yeah,
shoe.
The orange yeah. shoe yeah, 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 yeah. with the flames going on the side.
So still on the topic of carbon plated shoes and I guess plated shoes in general. I guess this concept has been around for a little bit. What I guess is the difference between Mizuno's wave plate and some of the plate technology that has been around longer compared to all of a sudden now plated shoes can make you run faster?
So Mizuno's always had, their shoes are all called Wave something, Wave Inspire, Wave Rider, Wave Sky, and that is more towards the plastic plate and not a carbon plate. So they've been doing this for a long time, and On has a speed plate in it too. For most of their shoes, they're now coming out with them without. So it's more of just somebody that wants that sort of responsive feeling versus a skush kush. We use really technical terms like marshmallow cushion.
I love it.
Skush kush versus responsive cushion and thinking of Tigger, that sort of thing. So Mizuno's done it very successfully for a number of years where they have that plastic plate or you see the wave going through it. And that's just to give a little bit more of a boost off the shoe.
That makes sense. That's helpful. So one thing too that you touched on maybe like three comments ago that I'm slowly actually coming back to, you mentioned the nomenclature of last of a shoe. And I think this is really important when people are asking, okay, what is the perfect shoe for me? Because the last of the shoe obviously can kind of shape how it's fitting. Do you want to touch on what is the last of a shoe and why is it important?
So the last of the shoe, I would say 90% of the shoes that today are made on like an S last and a curved last, meaning that the shoe has a little bit of a waistline through. If you turn the shoe upside or look at the sole of the shoe, you would see that it gets a little narrower through the arch and then comes back out at the heel. And that's the way most shoes are made now. We carry straight lasted shoes. That's a very small population of shoes. Those shoes are super orthotic friendly. So somebody that has orthopedic or orthotic issues would benefit more from a straight lasted shoe where they can put their Mac Daddy orthotic in. You know, we have people that come in with big orthotics because their feet hurt and they have leg length differentials or they have other comorbidities that are causing this situation where they need to have some sort of a big orthotic, and those orthotics don't typically work in a shoe that is kind of a curved last or an S-last curved last. So there are the shoes that are straight lasted, and that's usually we fit somebody that is a walker, has a big orthotic, may have a very high volume foot, a very wide foot, a very tall foot, something that they need that bigger, straighter platform to put their foot in. So very, very small population of people, but we do carry it because we want people to be comfortable and move forward the best way they can.
So we talked about the carbon trends, and I did want to address, people find a shoe that they love. They find a brand and a model that they love, and then inevitably it changes a year later. Can you talk to us about what the brands are usually trying to change when they change a model a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So it's so funny because people will say, oh, you know, I had the whatever 13, the version 13. And then they updated it and I hated it. Yep. I hated it. So I went on eBay or Amazon and I bought 700 pairs of them. And I have a whole closet that has that brand 13 in their closet. And the first thing that we'll say to somebody is, at some point you have to break up with a shoe. Sorry. Yeah. And the other thing is that when you buy shoes, if you have a favorite shoe and they replace it and it's not what you like, don't go out and buy every single stock of that shoe. The foams harden after time.
Yeah.
Things get a little stiff and not well. And also, if you're buying a shoe from three iterations ago, you have no idea where that shoe was being stored. And if it was in somebody's warehouse at 150 degrees, that will change the dynamic of the shoe. So let's just sit down, have a little counseling, and figure out what
get through
shoe
it together.
Get through it together. And the other thing is, a lot of people now, there's so much information. There's so many people out there doing shoe reviews. It's good to read them, but come in and try for yourself. Because again, somebody may be pointing something out that you've never had an issue with, and now you're going to make it an issue. So coming in and trying a shoe for yourself. And then if you do realize, wow, this just the way they cut it this time doesn't feel well, or the fabric isn't letting my foot breathe because I have a sweaty foot, and now I'm feeling like I'm really sweaty when I get done, then let's find another shoe for you. Typically when a shoe updates, and most shoes will go through a big update about every 18 months, it's because the brands are thinking forward for you. The technologies are changing so much, and they want to give you the best shoe that they can. It's typically not because they're trying to make a shoe cheaper.
Yeah.
I will say that right outright. They are trying to make the shoe better. And they may have, and think about this, we buy shoes. Our footwear buyer is buying shoes right now that are coming out in next year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So if a shoe...
So what's the future? What does it look like?
Yeah.
This is crazy.
Exciting. It's fun. But the point is that if a brand produces a shoe that is coming out today, and it's the new launch of a shoe that's been in line for a while, and they realize that the tongue isn't great on that shoe, they've already made those for the next year. And it may be two iterations before that shoe gets completely changed again, before they realize it, because shoes are being made so far in advance, or designed so far in advance. And so you really have to think about it. We had a problem with a shoe, and the shoe brand, it took them about a year and a half to correct it.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, sometimes you have to live through that experience.
Yeah.
And some people will notice it and some people don't. And we definitely don't bring it to people's attention because, again, we really, really pay attention to, we call it the foot brain. We pay attention to somebody's foot brain. And if we think, oh, this is the shoe that's perfect for you, we're never going to say that outright. We're going to let their foot brain determine that. And they may say, it feels perfect, except for this little spot on my heel. All right, we got to switch.
All right.
So I think that answered your question.
Yeah, definitely.
I think we've covered everything that we could cover surface level today. Or we really could sit here for 3 more hours. But we have to ask the fun questions now.
Of course.
So first, I want to know, what are you running in these days?
Oh, gosh. You know, this is such a fun question because I'm a little bit of a, I don't know, a Mel DeMarcos of shoes, if anybody remembers
his
thousands of shoes. But I'm definitely a mood shoe person.
Okay.
But my shoe of choice right now, I really am enjoying, is the ASICS Superblast.
Okay.
Nice.
ASICS, been in a brand forever. And it's really fun when a brand has been around, it's an iconic brand, that a couple years that were not so great, and now all of a sudden they've dialed it in. But again, speaking to that sort of life cycle of a shoe, once a shoe's canned and designed, it might be a year and a half or two before that shoe gets where it needs to be again. So I love that shoe. That's my long chainer shoe. It's a really bouncy, springy shoe, but a lot of cushion. And being a little bit older, I appreciate cushion. In the woods, my favorite shoe is the Torrent, Hoka Torrent.
Nice.
And that's a great shoe. I love that shoe. I am not one that can do a big stack height in the woods because I don't lift my feet up. So I'm a little bit of a tripper.
Yeah.
So I can still get that Hoka cushion with a little bit lower profile shoe.
I love that shoe too. All right. Next question. What is your pump up song for a race?
Oh, I don't listen to music.
Ah, okay. Even before? You're in the car, like driving to the race.
Oh, yeah.
You got to get in the zone.
So I'm an Ironman athlete. I've done a lot of Ironman.
Yeah, you are.
And Mike Riley, who's the voice of Ironman, they always have their little pump up music that you hear in the morning and A Beautiful Day.
Oh, that's perfect.
Oh, that's
great. It's kind of like my song. When I hear that, I know that everything's going to be okay. And it's a great song. But I don't run with music and I don't really listen to a lot of music. Well, I listen to a lot of music in my car, but I don't run with it at all. And I always, people will ask me why, and I'll say, listen, I have so many people talking to me in my head. If a podcast is coming on or there's music, I'm going to be, you know, I'm solving my world's problems and probably Brit's problems and your problems. Like, you know, I don't need other voices in my head.
You're like that too, Brendan, right? You don't run with anything.
Yeah, I'm the exact same way.
I like to hear my heart. I like to hear my lungs. I like to hear the road.
Yeah.
I think it's fun to hear your footfall.
Yeah.
It just is, to me, it's meditation that is what my daily need is.
Yeah. All right. I think we've hit our max for today. Megan, thank you so much for joining us. Seriously, so much fun. Guys, check out Darien and Richfield Running Stores. It's my go-to. I go there once a month. I stock up on everything. Brendan does too. Sometimes he knows I'm there. He texts me and says, can you pick up some blah, blah, blah? And I do.
It's true.
So again, thank you so much. And listeners, we'll be back for our final marathon Monday in September.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.